the British system as a parliamentary democracy, with minimal interference in the nation's day-to-day affairs by the Queen. But like everything else in modern Britain, appearances can be deceptive. Even the most intrinsic feature of modern government, namely legislation. On the surface, the process of legislation in the UK is undertaken by both the Houses of Parliament and the government of the day, playing a central role in introducing proposed legislation in the form of bills. But the monarch plays an influential role both at the beginning and end of the legislative process through the Queen's consent and assent. With the former signifying the sovereign's agreement with parliamentary debate on a proposed piece of legislation, and the latter marking the sovereign's seal of approval to a bill that has successfully completed the parliamentary process.
Grateful, and I think my views on this are pretty well understood.
Indeed, a bill only becomes an act or law of the land once it has been granted royal assent by the Queen. It might be argued that none of this dissents in a fundamental way from the principles of constitutional monarchy insofar as the sovereign is expected to play a symbolic role in the legislative process. But nothing could be further from the truth. As the Queen actively employs her power of withholding consent for proposed legislation, often in concert with and the active collusion of a sitting government. This often occurs when a sitting government wants to stop proposed legislation which originates from the inner circles of policymaking. Therefore, briefing the Queen and persuading her to withhold her consent from the bill, to be even discussed in Parliament, is the most effective way of stopping inconvenient proposed legislation in its tracks. In keeping with the British tradition of secrecy, records are not kept as to how many times the Queen has exercised her power to withhold consent from proposed legislation entering the parliamentary fray.
In the House of Peers.
But the public know of at least three occasions. The Titles Bill, 1964. The Rhodesia Independence Bill, 1969. And the Military Action Against Iraq Bill, 1999. On all three occasions, the bills were proposed by backbenchers in the House of Commons, and on all three occasions, the sitting government quashed the initiatives by way of persuading the Queen to intervene.
That her attack on the BBC.
In fact, whereas the UK is continually at pains to project itself as the world's leading parliamentary democracy, with Parliament supposedly acting as the will of the people, the truth is that an unelected sovereign plays a central role in the legislative process, both in passive and active capacities. In February 2021, The Guardian revealed that more than 1,000 laws have been vetted by the Queen or Prince Charles through a secretive procedure before they were approved by the UK's elected members of Parliament. The huge number of laws subject to royal vetting cover matters ranging from justice, social security, pensions, race relations, and food policy, through to obscure rules on car parking charges and hovercraft. The wealth of the royal family in terms of fixed assets is concentrated in two crown bodies, the Duchy of Lancaster and Duchy of Cornwall. The Duchy of Lancaster is by far the most consequential as it constitutes the private estate of the sovereign Queen Elizabeth II. The Duchy of Cornwall, meanwhile, belongs to the eldest son of the reigning monarch, which currently is Prince Charles. These holdings, or crown bodies, to use British political jargon, merely represents the vast estates, including palaces, that belong to the royal family and which the state upkeeps with taxpayers' money. But the Queen's wealth, as well as other leading members of the royal family, exceeds the value of the buildings and lands held by the two duchies. As far back as 2001, the Mail on Sunday calculated that the Queen was worth £1.15 billion, with her vast investment portfolio worth £500 million alone. The Queen reportedly is an avid collector of expensive and exotic items. Her collection alone was worth an eye-watering £100 million. But as faithful as he was to the pertinent facts, Hall's description was, by all credible accounts, an underestimate. In 2017, the Paradise Paper leak revealed that millions of pounds from the private estate of Britain's Queen Elizabeth II had been invested in offshore tax haven funds. The royal family doesn't have to pay a single penny for the upkeep of the vast estates under their control. And needless to say, members of the royal household don't pay a single penny in income tax either. Or any other form of tax, for that matter. And that's just the beginning, as the royal family receives a more than generous stipend from the state to maintain their lavish lifestyles, all at the expense of the out-of-pocket British taxpayer. The current legislative framework for funding the lifestyle and expenses of the royal family is embodied in the Sovereign Grant Act 2011, which replaced the civil list mechanism established by King George III in 1760. On the face of it, the new arrangement is advantageous to the monarchy, as income from the old civil list in the years 2001 to 2011 was fixed at £7.9 million annually. By contrast, in 2012, the new sovereign grant scheme funneled an exorbitant £1 million into the pockets of the royal household. In the year 2018 to 2019, this had increased to a staggering £82.8 million, and by all accounts, it is set to rise by at least 8 to 10% annually for the foreseeable future. To place financial arrangements on a more favourable footing, the royals could always rely on the Tory party, which had for the past 180 years, since its foundation in the 1830s, championed the cause of monarchy as part of its broader right-wing political and ideological agenda.
If Parliament were a school.
When the Conservative Party came to power following the May 2010 general election, albeit as part of a coalition government with the Liberal Democrats, they quickly set about abolishing the civil list arrangement of 1760. The then Tory Chancellor, George Osborne, contrived a scheme, doubtless in close consultation with the Queen and her son Prince Charles, which would replace the 1760 deal with a new arrangement whereby a percentage of the profits of the Crown estate would be diverted to royal accounts. This was initially set at 15% of profits annually, but has subsequently been increased to 25% to cover a bells and whistles upgrade to Buckingham Palace. Osborne and the Tories went the extra mile to please the Queen and her eldest son. For, as part of the New Deal, if income from the Crown estates fell one year, the royals would be compensated for the loss. And vice versa, in the event of above-inflation income stream, the royals get to pocket the excess. The arrangement of 2011 has all the trappings of placing the royal family above the vicissitudes of the British economy. Despite its massive constitutional significance and considerable financial implications, information about this new arrangement was kept to a small circle within the government. It was rushed through a small committee in the House of Commons, with only the Scottish National Party objecting to its terms.
This is almost the kind of behaviour we would expect to see in the Duma in Moscow.
To make matters worse, the draft legislation was personally delivered to Prince Charles by the pliant Tory Chancellor Osborne so that the Queen's eldest son could issue his consent to the proposed legislation. Britain is not an anomaly in Europe in terms of having a monarchy. Excluding the UK, there are 9 monarchies left in Europe. But what sets the European monarchies apart from Britain's royal family is their genuine and robust constitutional status, in addition to multiple layers of oversight exercised over them to prevent abuse of power and privilege. For example, under Article 19 of the Norwegian Constitution, in order for the king to accede to the throne, he has to make the following pledge. I promise and swear that I will govern the Kingdom of Norway in accordance with the Constitution. Similarly, Article 32 of the Dutch Constitution requires that the king shall swear or promise allegiance to the Constitution and that he will faithfully discharge his duties. The remaining monarchies in Europe are truly constitutional, insofar as they are subordinate to the policies which they purport to represent. By stark contrast, the British monarchy stands not only above democracy, but above the law itself. Indeed, they like to think they are the law, inasmuch as they do whatever they please, including accumulating wealth without paying a penny in tax. Seen in this context, the British royal family constitutes Europe's largest imperial monarchy, apparently impervious to the vicissitudes of politics and history. It doesn't stop there, as even their upkeep far exceeds that of their European counterparts. The decadence and greed of the British monarchy puts European monarchies, indeed monarchies across the world, to shame. As for palaces, for example, the Spanish, Dutch and Danish royal families each have access to only 2 palaces. The House of Windsor, meanwhile, occupies 15 state residences, and that figure excludes privately owned estates like Balmoral Castle and Sandringham House. Monarchies around the world are adapting fast to political developments, if only to ensure their survival in an age of forensic scrutiny. Japan, which credibly claims to be the oldest monarchy in the world, is leading the way by trying to create as much distance as possible between the royal family and public expenditure. Prince Akishino, who is next in line to succeed Emperor Naruhito, announced that the royal family should cover the expense of succession ceremony from its own funds, as opposed to relying on the state treasury to cover the costs. This is a world away from the dreamscape occupied by Queen Elizabeth II, her heirs and entourage. Despite their vast wealth, the royals make liberal use of public resources for their own pleasure and comfort. For instance, Prince William, who many believe will be the next king as Charles may abdicate in favour of his oldest son, once used a military helicopter to fly to a stag party. By the same token, the royals are not shy of using fabulously wealthy people's private resources either. In 2018, the American actor and producer George Clooney treated Prince Harry and his wife Meghan Markle to a decadent holiday in Italy. Clooney reportedly flew the royal couple there in his private jet and gave them unfettered access to his luxurious 25-room villa. The question is, what, if anything, Clooney got in return for his extraordinary generosity? When the scandal about the couple's penchant for private jets first broke out, some observers were puzzled as to why the singer and songwriter Elton John had been so keen to leap to Harry and Meghan's defence. The answer may lie in the fact that the royal family uses its wealth and privilege to cultivate famous and influential types, exactly for such occasions when it needs to polish up its public image. Modern Britain is a country of contrasts, not to mention deep contradictions. The dizzyingly complex mix of traditions, mores, and an apparently insatiable postmodern impulse has created a country that is hard to decipher, let alone fully understand. And so it is with the monarchy. On the surface, most Britons appear to support the antiquated institution, not just on the grounds of sentimentalism, but also good old-fashioned British pragmatism. And yet, the UK is home to a small but vocal Republican community.
I'm here to protest the unaccountable power of the Crown, what it symbolises, which is hereditary privilege, and the constitutional power that it still has.
We don't need that kind of icon. No, much better icons are, you know, things like ideas like democracy and the equality of citizenship, and maybe someone chosen by us to represent us.
The fact of the matter is, there is no credible evidence or indication even that the British public wants to abolish the monarchy, except for very cosmetic changes to the monarchy and only to placate public anger, never to reform the monarchy itself. Based on this clear political reality, the British monarchy is set to survive the 21st century, perhaps with little, if any, substantial change. But a parallel development points to the diminution of the UK's role in the world, perhaps even the breakup of the UK itself, as evidenced by the strengthening independence movement in Scotland and, to a lesser extent, Wales. As Britain becomes more parochial, the rest of the world is likely to care much less about the House of Windsor, and that may be a punishment worse than death for Britain's media-conscious royal family.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم كذلك وأورثناها بني إسرائيل.
Thus, and we caused to inherit it the children of Israel.
فأتبعوهم مشرقين.
So they pursued them at sunrise.
Brothers and sisters, we were into the 59th verse of the chapter. وَكَذَلِكَ وَأَوْرَثْنَاهَا بَنِي إِسْرَائِيلِ فَأَتْبَعُوهُمْ مُشْرِقِينَ, the 60th verse. Thus, we drowned them and we made the children of Israel the inheritors to them. فَأَتْبَعُوهُمْ مُشْرِقِينَ, and then they pursued them at sunrise. These are the verses that mention the declination of Pharaoh and ruling of the children of Israel. In the previous verses, the Holy Quran said, فَأَخْرَجْنَاهُمْ مِنْ جَنَّاتٍ وَعُيُونٍ وَكُنُوزٍ وَمَقَامٍ كَرِيمٍ. We expelled them from the gardens and the springs and the treasures and a goodly dwelling they had. But all these things were taken from them, and Allah causes the children of Israel to inherit them. One point remaining about this maqamin kareem is that the commentators have different opinions about this phrase, maqamin kareem, that we translated as goodly dwelling. Some say that it means luxurious palaces and expensive houses. Some believe that it means gatherings and meetings of the rulers, which were encircled with some obedient officers. And these two commentaries are somehow consistent. It is likely that both of them are included in the concept of the verse, both their palaces and their power and positions. They were all taken from them. Now, so the Almighty Allah says that He causes the children of Israel to inherit them. كَذَلِكَ وَأَوْرَثْنَاهَا بَنِي إِسْرَائِيلِ. Thus we drowned them, and we made the children of Israel to inherit them. Some commentators believe that the children of Israel came back to Egypt and ruled the country for some time, but the point is that the verses are apparently in line with this commentary. But some others believe that after sinking of Pharaoh and his men, they went to the Holy Lands, but after a length of time, they returned to Egypt and established a government there. This second commentary has the concerning chapters of current Torah supportive of it. Some say that the children of Israel were divided into different groups. One group remained in Egypt and ruled, and the other group went with Moses to the Holy Land. However, as the last verse implies, Pharaoh sent his men to the cities of Egypt. He gathered enough army and forces to pursue them.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly, the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So Pharaoh gathered his men, and he gathered enough army and forces to pursue this Bani Israel that went with Moses. Some commentators believe that Pharaoh sent 600,000 men as an advance guard, and then he himself followed them with 100,000 soldiers. They moved fast at night and pursued them, and they reached Moses when the sun was rising, as the Holy Quran says, فَأَتْبَعُوهُمْ مُشْرِقِينَ. Then they pursued them at sunrise. The doer of the action, Atba'u, are the soldiers of Pharaoh and Pharaoh himself. So Pharaoh's host pursued them, and the object of the verb is them, that means Moses and his people. Now, this is the point that we understand. The Almighty Allah in the previous verses said, فَأَخْرَجْنَاهُمْ. We made them go away, we expelled them, and this is the result. The Almighty Allah has a kind of tadbir in every action he has. And this is the tadbir, this is the hikmah in this. He expelled them, and this is the result. He made them pursue the Moses and his people, and he made them drown. And that is why, and that's how exactly he made the children of Israel the inheritors of Pharaoh and his people. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry, in your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me, worry ends when faith begins.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a question that is about something that people who have been blessed with the chance and opportunity to visit the shrine of Imam Ridha alayhi salam, the eighth Imam in Mashhad, will be acquainted with. The question is this regarding the steel window or almost gate that is located in the shrine of Imam Ridha, and which people visit and they, you know, kiss and they, they seek their needs and requests at that place. Sometimes they, tie a ribbon there, asking God to give them, to heal them from, you know, ailments, right? So the question is whether there's any basis in this in religion or not. Is there some riwayat, some tradition, hadith regarding it? Or why is it that people, respect this steel, this iron gate, this window so much? So the answer to this question is that obviously this such a window didn't exist in the era of the Imams alayhi wasalam, right? So there's no and at the same time there was no request made by the Imams to build them such a steel window after they die on their graves, right? So there's nothing to indicate the sanctity or sacredness of such a thing within the traditions themselves. However, historically, when the Safaviyya, the famous rulers, Shia rulers, who were responsible for the building of the shrines of the Imams, alayhi wasalam, when they were building the shrine of Imam Ridha, alayhi salam, right, so this iron window, this steel window, this panjareya fulad, as they call it in Persian, it was constructed, and at that time when this was constructed, people could look through this and they could see the grave of Imam Ridha alayhi salam from the window, right? So people would come and they would stand in front of the window, they would and look at the grave of Imam Ridha, and they would ask Allah by the right of Imam Ridha for their needs, for their hajat, and for the cure to their ailments and whatnot, right? So this gave this window a certain sanctity, a certain sacredness. People began coming there at the window, and it became popular, and people became loving it, and it acquired this name. So, and there's nothing wrong with this, because this is not what we call a bid'at or an innovation in religion, right? Because technically speaking, a bid'at or an innovation in religion, which has been prohibited obviously in Islam, is to add something to religion which is not a part of religion, with the intention that it is a part of religion, right? In other words, relating this thing, ascribing it to religion, when it really has no basis in religion, right? So here in this case, we're not doing that. We're not saying that, oh, this is something that we took from the Imams alayhi wasalam, or it's been mentioned in the Quran, it's the sunnah of the Prophet. No, we respect this window, we love it because of its connection to Imam Ridha alayhi wasalam, but we're not saying that it's necessarily a part of religion in the sense mentioned just now. Therefore, it doesn't fall under this category of bid'at or innovation in religion. and therefore the prohibition of bidat is not related to it. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the iron window of Imam Ridha's shrine. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Aperture. As humans, the Earth is our home. It is the only home we have. The Earth is where we live, breathe, eat, and raise the future generation. Our entire life support system is dependent on the well-being of our natural environment and all of the species living on this beautiful blue planet. But what have we done to it? How have we preserved it? I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Unfortunately, our planet is in grave danger. Many species of animals and plants are nearing extinction. Our clean air and water supply is at risk, and more of our beautiful open spaces are disappearing as new buildings and factories are built. What is worse is that the Earth is getting warmer and warmer as we speak. This week's exclusive documentary explores the perilous state of our planet. Stay with us for the first part.
Issue the tsunami warning.
Gives us a clear idea of what's happening.
The cloud is now moving south. It's harmless to people on the
ground. Covered with thousands of miles, why doesn't that energy dissipate?
The Earth isn't feeling well.
That is a year.
Its fever has risen, and its situation is getting worse by the day.
Nowadays, we hear people saying the Earth's temperature is rising.
The average temperature of the Earth was about 15 degrees Celsius in the beginning of the 20th century. During the Ice Age, the average temperature of the Earth was only 5 degrees less.
Take into consideration this 15 degrees and compare it to the 10 degree average during the Ice Age. Now, if this 15 degrees, God forbid, reaches 19 or 20 degrees, what age could you call that? The ebullient age?
Naturally, the subsistence of life will end way before the ebullient age.
Of course, the Earth has other problems as well, but climate change or global warming is a major problem, which increases the frequency of droughts, storms, and other consequences and natural disasters that take place on the Earth's surface.
The existence of icebergs in the north and south poles calls reflection of solar energy, which is known as albedo. Without an ice cover, this energy will be absorbed by the Earth's surface and accelerate global warming, altering the average temperature on planet Earth. We can say the Earth has a fever. It may be 1 degree or 1 200 degrees.
There's a very simple formula. Q is heat energy.
which is equal to the mass of substance multiplied by C, which is a specific heat capacity multiplied by delta T. A 2-degree delta T, for instance, is multiplied by a huge mass at a specific heat capacity, which sums up to what? A very large Q. And what does that all mean? It means that all these signals I'm giving you are alarming. And it means that I'm continuously moving from the green line into the orange and red lines and into the danger zone.
Greenhouse gases are gases that can trap wavelengths larger than 4 microns within themselves. These are wavelengths that are radiated to the Earth from the Sun, and when reflected from the surface of the Earth, elements become trapped within the wavelengths. They trap greenhouse gases and absorb heat, which leads to the gradual warming of the Earth.
Just like inside a greenhouse, as in the ones used for farming, when solar radiation penetrates into it, the trapped heat is not completely removed, and it causes the inside of the greenhouse to become warmer than the outside. Greenhouse gases play the same role in the Earth's atmosphere.
Greenhouse gases per se are very useful. The existence of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, which we usually refer to as carbon dioxide, is very useful because without these gases, the temperature of the Earth would fall to minus 19 degrees Celsius. Minus 19 degrees Celsius means a total freeze. It means no agricultural or farming product would be able to grow. Obviously, it wouldn't provide the requirements for human existence on the Earth. The existence of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and the partial trapping of energy reflections from the Earth have caused the Earth's temperature to rise to 15 degrees Celsius. In other words, greenhouse gases have caused a 34-degree temperature rise. This process has obviously created the ideal situation we have for all living creatures to thrive.
A forest is one factor responsible for absorbing greenhouse gases. It is necessary for soaking up greenhouse gases. Unfortunately, forests around the world are being brutally desecrated for their wood and their land. You can see many instances of deforestation around the world. Deforestation has taken place to enable farming, but also for building factories and cities. When these forests are destroyed, the global sources for absorbing greenhouse gases are weakened.
With the proliferation of greenhouse gases and the increase of human activities on the surface of the Earth, which has provided the growth and spread of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, the basis for absorbing and trapping thermal energy that is reflected from the surface of the Earth is further provided in the atmosphere.
The atmosphere's capacity for greenhouse gases is 2,900 gigatons.
And until now, in the year 2010, about 65% of its capacity has been emitted. So from 2010 until the year 2100, the atmosphere only has the capacity to handle another 35%.
And obviously the basis has been provided for the Earth's average temperature of 15 degrees to rise to 15.5, 15.7 or 15.9 degrees and even to 16 degrees at times.
از این 1900 گیگاتون منتشر شده در کل جهان در اتمسفر.
A large portion of the 1900 gigatons emitted into the atmosphere belongs to countries which have caused more emissions starting from the 1840s and 1850s.
1840 و 1850 اینها رو بیشتر از کشورهای دیگر منتشر کرد. کشورهای در حال توسعه.
Developing countries with 81% of the world's population have only emitted 26% of these gases.
Therefore, we're facing a very serious humanitarian hazard, and we need to take serious measures to stop the emission of greenhouse gases.
Progress is being made, however. Beijing authorities are closing factories and outlawing burning coal for heating.
Naturally, a rise in the average temperature of the surface of the Earth from moderate levels can have bad consequences, and temperatures higher than that can pave the way for various disasters on the Earth's surface.
We're working in a totally unsustainable way. We do things to feel at ease, but we only have one planet Earth. We can't later immigrate and leave this planet. If we destroy it, where else can we go? This is it. And the destruction we're causing with technological development is enough to put our lives at risk now. As a human being, I'd ask, what sort of technological development have we accomplished? What sort of technology have we achieved? Or what have we done for human comfort that hasn't harmed us in any way? Give me one example.
The skyline is littered with factories, and toxic smoke pours into the air day and night. For those living here, it's a choice between pollution and unemployment.
The federal appeals court upheld the Environmental Protection Agency's emission standards for hazardous air pollutants from coal and oil-fired power plants. The court rejected state and industry challenges to rules designed to clean up mercury,
lead. The European Parliament said reducing supply in the CO2 trading market would boost prices.
What does it mean to live in a polluted place? It means that particles, say 5 microns, 2.5 microns and 1 micron increase. Carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide increase. Now it depends on the quality of the gasoline and the gas that you use. The sulfur and nitrogen derivatives, ozone and finally soot and particulates all scatter in the air and they eventually enter the body either through the nose or the mouth. So body cells that start from the nose, eyes and mouth and reach the depth of the lungs are all affected, and these substances enter the bloodstream through the respiratory system.
It affects the brain. We become tired fast. We become impatient. We quickly lose our temper and verbally assault each other. There's no need for one to be ill. Those who are ill are at greater risk.
Thank you.
We only see B2B, business to business. Just business to business. It's usually called B2B. This is a disaster. Even if it means death and costs us our lives, which is our most important index, we have a brain. We don't use it. The only thing we see in business is the money. Everything depends on how deep one's pockets are.
Development is a natural process in human growth, which has existed for thousands of years. It's now been accelerated, becoming faster and stranger. But during this development process, some of us have become rich. Some are filling up their bank accounts and becoming wealthy. It's interesting, though, that these same people, sometimes directly, but most times indirectly, have to somehow return this money.
The oil leaked for 87 days, the worst offshore spill in U.S. history. BP was later found to be grossly negligent for the explosion aboard the Deepwater Horizon platform. And today, it agreed to a settlement that will include a $5.5 billion fine for violations of the Clean Water Act, $7.1 billion to the U.S. government and five states to repair coastlines smeared by oil, $4.9 billion to settle economic claims by those five states, and up to $1 billion to 400 local governments. Louisiana, the most heavily damaged, gets almost $7 billion, the biggest share.
This is by no means chance and accident. Our experience in development over the past 100 or 200 years shows that technological advancement and city living have been the cause of this. Name any technology you like, or whatever has made human existence easier, and you'll find it's harmed the environment.
China has announced the successful containment of its worst ever reported oil spill, although much work remains to be done before an ongoing cleanup is complete. At a media briefing, the vice mayor of the northeastern coastal city of Dalian, where the spill occurred, said workers had used more than 40 kilometers of oil barriers and 65 tons of absorbent pads to stop the slick reaching international waters. Yet with oil remaining on beaches and in the water, he also acknowledged a full cleanup will be an arduous task.
Go back 160 years in time to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the Industrial Age in the 1850s, to see an impact.
It's been about a century that we humans have opted for consumerism on the earth, and as we have moved forward in recent decades, consumer demand has risen.
Until a point, we lived along with the earth and the nature. From a point onwards, we just forgot about what the earth is, where it's come from, and where this kind of usage will lead us to. We just want everything. The high consumer demand that we're witnessing these days is just destroying the earth's natural resources.
But a leading scientist suggests the reasons for the drought may be even more worrying for Brazil in the long run. Has continued deforestation in the Amazon and in the Atlantic forest drastically altered the climate?
We created the packaging industry to be able to easily relocate food products and conserve them for longer periods, so we would be able to keep a packet of food or fruit juice for, say, 2 weeks without it being spoiled. What's been the outcome? Go take a look at the landfills to see what we've done to the earth by producing all this garbage. Garbage that can't be recycled. It was done for our comfort, but it's also put our future in danger.
If we move back a few decades, there were a limited number of countries that were consumer-based and that used a lot of energy and products like the United States and in Europe. But these days, global consumption on Earth has sharply increased as countries in East Asia, especially China, have started boosting their consumption.
About 56% of these greenhouse gases are produced by fossil fuels.
Naturally, the rise in the use of fossil fuels is due to energy requirements of machines used for ever-expanding development projects. To boost the machine age, the industrial age. Due to this boosting process, the developed world has had to increase its use of different kinds of fossil fuels. This has paved the way for partial deforestation, which aims to provide the agricultural requirements to cover total food needs of a growing global population. This causes change to the optimal 15 degree world average temperature.
In the northeastern prefecture of Miyagi, and what you're looking at right now on the screen is in the city of Sendai.
A couple of feet of water, so they have to stand out there until they can manage to get the boat across and then take a big group of them into an entrance rack and ramp of ice.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, this is the Minbar you're listening to. Today we invite you to listen to an English lecture by Brother Amin Rastani.
The Prophet says there are 10 things though of the dunya that this person will get, and there are 10 things of the akhirah that this person will get. Inshallah, we'll go through these tonight quickly. He says 10 of them in the dunya, 10 of them the akhirah, as for those that are in the dunya. Number one, hub of my Ahlul Bayt is going to have the benefit of az-zuhd fi dunya. Wow. Love of Ahlul Bayt will entail the fact that I'm not too interested in this dunya. Al-hirsu ala al-amal, number two. Number three, al-wara'u fi d-din. Wara' means extra precaution. We have a hadith that says, akhuka dinuk fahtat lidinik. Your brother is your deen and religion. Have some ihtiyat when it comes to your religion. Now, our fiqh, alhamdulillah, our fuqaha, our maraji, have identified which place